This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
Today I'm joined by Katie Dittweiler, who is a doctoral candidate in cultural anthropology at the New School for Social Research in New York City. And she's been talking to the ALMA team at Manchester. So first, I'm going to ask, what are you here for?
I've been having a really interesting afternoon having conversations here with the ALMA team about how they're managing the masses data that is coming from ALMA and from the desert of northern Chile, where I just spent about 14 months doing research for my PhD project. And actually, I was in Europe on a completely different project working in Poland for the past 2 weeks. And since I was already here, I decided to come visit the UK and get in touch with the ALMA team here, because I spent quite a lot of time in Chile looking at sort of, you could call it like the production side of this massive data. But even after 14 months, by the time I left, I had really no feeling or sensibility for what happens with the data when it travels and how people work with it and what the challenges are. And so I'm starting to piece that together. And that was this afternoon.
Just for our listeners, ALMA is an acronym for the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, which is obviously in Chile. And were you staying at the site then?
No, I was living in the community of San Pedro de Atacama, which is near the base, about 20-minute drive from the ALMA OSF, which is the Operations Support Facility, the base camp, and where the telescope is operated from and where maintenance on the antenna happens, as well as some processing. And so I was in San Pedro for most of the time that I was in Chile, but also working a little in some other communities that are near optical telescopes operated mostly by ESO, the European Southern Observatory. And I mean, maybe I should start by saying how I found myself in Chile.
Yeah. Tell us about why you have decided on this project. Yeah.
So I did my undergraduate degree in anthropology. I did my master's in anthropology at the New School. And then in our program, you have to do the master's to even be eligible to apply for the PhD. So we go from a cohort of like 25 master's students to a PhD cohort of like 3 to 5. And so I'd done the master's program, and I was quite fascinated with anthropology, sort of as an object of study. The history of the discipline is very complex, and changes in the discipline tend to map onto new epistemic forms and political terms. And so I was quite fascinated with the history of anthropology, but most people coming into a PhD program have a very specific project. Like, they want to study sex workers' rights in China, or they want to study food practices in Paris suburbs amongst Senegalese immigrants.
So you weren't originally focused on astronomical practices in indigenous populations?
I was not. I was focused on nothing, and this was a problem. So my faculty said, look, we've let you into the program, but you really have to have a project. And I said, well, I don't have one. I'm not sure where in the world I want to study or what. And they said, okay, well, I'm sorry, but you have to have a project. And so I said, okay, fine, I choose the universe. But then I was sort of stuck with it, and I had to figure out where in the world I would actually do this research. Anthropological fieldwork tends to be a year, but it does have to be in a place. And so this sort of brought me to Chile in 2012. I was doing preliminary research in Chile. So I knew there was a huge scientific and technological production around astronomy in Chile. And so I went to sort of investigate this. And simultaneously was erupting, at least for me, I started paying attention to this discourse of the age of big data. And at the time, and maybe it still is this way, but at the time it was talked about in really revolutionary terms. Like, this is...
It's a big buzzword that's being thrown around a lot in our own department, because obviously technology is getting better and better, and you get all of these great, fantastic telescopes. Well, not just in astronomy, but you get all these great ways of generating more data than you can manage as a person, as a team, even as people. So it's a big problem we're looking to tackle in ways like, well, different computer algorithms to automate things and things that projects like Galaxy Zoo as well.
Yeah, right.
Citizen science.
Right. So it provokes lots of challenges and opportunities, some of which look democratic and helpful and things like this. But the rhetoric I was paying attention to was this idea that we're living in an epistemic break, and that we're shifting from the third to the fourth paradigm of science, or that big data means the death of the theorist, these sort of very grand statements about a real change in epistemology and how we think about knowledge. And what I wanted to know was, just like, you know, as you're saying, I wanted to know how people who are working in the midst of an epistemic break could possibly narrate that. Typically, big breaks in thought and ways of thinking about thought are named retrospectively. And it seems really interesting to me how people are trying to name a rift that we are inside of, and how, especially when it's something like thought, you can't ever be outside of your epistemology. So it's very hard to see if there's a new epistemology coming or forming, because we're never outside of our own.
Is this just a symptom of sort of accelerating society? The fact that over the last few years we made so many leaps and bounds, that now we can see something coming, which is that we're going to have too much data to handle, and so we already know that we're going to have a problem, as opposed to having to look back retrospectively and see that there was a big change here or a big change there. Is that part of the reason for that?
I would not tend to go to a heavily tech-determinist logic, that this technology is provoking a crisis, or that this technology is allowing us to see a crisis. It's all a little bit less clear. But I do think we have historical examples of massive floods of data provoking epistemological and political change.
Could you give us some examples?
I mean, I would think of the cosmological crisis produced by plant and animal specimens flooding in during the Age of Discovery, flooding into centers of knowledge in Europe and completely swamping existing categories. And out of this, you get lots of new architectures for knowledge to try to organize these things. I think that would be a big data prehistory, which removes the question of technology, which I kind of find useful.
But it also introduces some interesting other points. For example, I guess there were no laws about importing foreign species into countries before that, so they could all come in. So it influences more than just the topic that it actually is. It influences more than just biology, or in this case, more than just technology.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that. I think there are things that really should be paid attention to with the age of big data. The age of big data, the concerns people have tend to be around issues of privacy, security, ethical governance. Those are the critical discussions. And this more speculative side about how is this transforming ways of thinking and acting, provoking a revolution in how we live, work, and think, this kind of language, it is more speculative, but I think that these questions go together. And so, in a way, while studying big astronomical data in northern Chile, I'm also trying to develop a location in my dissertation where we can think about questions of data transformation, shifts in communities of practice or work, I'm talking about astronomical practice in this case, but a location where we can think about that in ways that don't look so overdetermined in terms of questions about Facebook tracking. In those kinds of situations, data is never interrogated as an interesting challenge of its own. And so something I really like about astronomy is how, in this current moment, is how articulate people are and how hard they're thinking about data and questions of organization, retrievability, quality, corruptibility, archiving, possibilities for archiving, the square kilometer array. Tom was just telling me its data will be so massive that at first, anyway, it won't be archived in raw form in any way. And he said something that I love as an anthropologist, which in that situation, the sky is the only archive. And you guys probably have that poetic language all the time. So I started to come to Chile in 2012. And I did, through connections to the University of Chile in Santiago, their Center for Mathematical Modeling, I went to ALMA for the first time. In 2012, and it was in, I would say, midway through construction at that point. And we talked a lot, or I listened to people talk a lot about computational capacities and challenges and network capacity challenges. And the computational specialist at ALMA told me, you know, we want infinity to be our ceiling. But he was talking about network capacity, not sort of knowledge of the universe. And so I realized this is a big data question where a non-specialist like myself, you'd think, you hear someone associated with an astronomical project saying we want infinity to be our universe. Obviously, that means, you know, knowledge of the cosmos, that kind of infinity,
everything.
But what he was actually using the word infinite to signify was capacity to move and manage massive data. And so that is a big data question where knowledge is increasingly associated with the capacity to move data.
So could you give us a quick overview of how the data is managed maybe within ALMA? Because ALMA is two separate sites in itself. Actually, could you give us a description of the site if you've been there?
Let me try to think of my first impressions. I'm actually from New Mexico in the U.S., which is in the Southwest, and it's a high desert environment. And when I came to the Atacama, obviously the Atacama is extreme. It's the driest non-polar desert on the planet, with, I think, experiencing about a millimeter of rain a year for 10 months of the year. And then for 2 months, there's the altiplanic winter, which brings some moisture. And some moisture also comes in on the Humboldt Current in a fog called the Camanchaca. I took the bus the first time I went, 24 hours on the bus from Santiago to San Pedro, which is sort of the oasis heart of the Atacama. And to my mind, being from New Mexico is extremely beautiful, but it is forbidding. It's wide, wide salt flats, which have flamingos, but it's a kind of like a crusted salt. It's not really like the Iuni salt flats you would think of from Bolivia. So when I got to the site, it was still under construction, and the site, by the site, I mean the operations support facility, which is sort of the base camp of ALMA. So all the antenna were down at the OSF being constructed, actually. So there were three different contractors who had contracts to build these antenna, a U.S. contractor, a European contractor, and a Japanese contractor. So these are the participant countries that together run ALMA, the United States, East Asia, and the European Southern Observatory, which has, I believe, 15 European states and now just about to add Brazil. So these are all the partners in ALMA, and each regional partner had its own contractor to build these antenna, and they all have different designs, actually, but they all have to meet the same specifications. And so that's one thing that's quite impressive, is how different the antenna are. When, before you're there, you hear so much about the synchronization of this data as ALMA's revolutionary potential.
So ALMA is an interferometer, which means that it collects data in lots and lots of different telescopes, and then it synchronizes it, and it uses basically long baselines, or the distances between the multiple antenna, in order to look very closely at small points on the sky.
Right. And so when you think about the synchronicity, and then you see how different actually these antenna are being built by different companies, and actually in different physical locations.
So are the shapes of the antenna different, like, depending on what they're built by?
They are. Mm-hmm. And of course, at some level, they're not different, and at some level, they really are. And it interested me also as an anthropologist that there was real separation between the different regional partners on the physical site who were building it. And for example, the U.S. company built, I believe it is now the largest steel and concrete windowless structure on the planet. They built this next to the ALMA base camp in order to build the antennas inside of it, obviously without dust or heat or sun.
Are there often storms then? Do they need to shield these antenna? Or?
There are never storms.
Yeah, okay.
Except in the altiplanic winter. But the Japanese contractors built their antenna out in the open air. And what else was going on? So there were huge shipping containers. Most of the technology came from abroad, obviously. The antennas came down. They were shipped to Antofagasta, the dishes themselves, which is the port city of northern Chile over on the west coast, and taken on semi-trucks through the Atacama Desert, creating quite a scene for local communities.
And wildlife, I suspect.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then they arrived at ALMA, and then they were finally fully assembled. And so when I was there, like, there's dishes on the ground and shipping containers everywhere. The people on site were living and sleeping in these shipping containers. I mean, they've obviously been retrofitted to be little bunks, essentially.
And could they spend long periods of time up there, or did they have to come down because of the altitude problems?
At the operation support facility, I believe it's 2,400 meters. The average person would feel it at first and get used to it immediately. But, for example, you can't drink alcohol at that altitude, and people who work there stay for, there's a detail about this that I never get right, but they stay for a shift and then they're away for a shift, like 10 days on, something like that. So for more than a week at a time, people are living at that altitude. And then the high site is 5,400 meters, and that is difficult. When I did go...
How long did you stay for?
An hour.
And did you feel it?
Oh,
yeah,
for sure.
What was it like?
It feels like your legs are made of concrete. It's incredibly exhausting to do anything, and you don't think very well. You don't problem solve very well. And actually, if I can go backtrack, so that was not on my first visit to Alman. And so when I first visited, I spoke with people who I met, and I said, look, you know, I'm a PhD student in anthropology. I want to come back and do my research here. And they said, we don't understand what an anthropologist wants to do here. Mm. What is an anthropology of an astronomical observatory? We don't really understand. And they said, you know, this is just not legible to us. And to some degree, that taps into a real anxiety and a bit of enmity between social science and the hard sciences. Mm. And
so was there a bit of hostility there? Or was it more just a concrete wall that was quite hard to get through in terms of correspondence in email?
It was a real resistance, which I don't think was mean-spirited or something. I think it taps into some, like, well-founded, sort of unstructured anxieties about the way that anthropology and social science in general has treated the hard sciences as what we would call, like, cultures of science. Mm. That would have been an earlier moment of anthropology, which basically often got read as saying science is just a system of meaning like any other, and everything is socially constructed, including scientific facts, and science is just one contingent and unstable discourse of truth like many others. And obviously this is really problematic. And scientists have a lot of sort of social memory about this. And so I think there was some anxiety about, like, why does a social scientist want to study hard scientists doing their work? But then there's more logistical difficulties, which is liability is a real question.
Yeah,
it's a very extreme place. And also, you know, ALMA is a brand new project. And they're, at least when I started visiting, they're really trying to figure themselves out and what kinds of access did they want. Now, as of this year, there's a public tours. Not of the high site, but of Operation Support Facility. So when I was trying to work on this question of access, they said, we just don't really have the mechanisms to give an anthropology student access. But what does make sense to us is the media. We understand the media. We understand what they want. And so I said, okay, I understand that.
Is there also a sense of we understand what they can do for us?
Definitely. Definitely, I think. And indeed, there's a huge amount of international media attention around ALMA, particularly, though, on its impressive machines, impressive technologies. And actually, still, you do see the science covered in the press. But at the beginning, it was the transporters. There's two transporters that move the antenna. They move them from OSF to the high site, and at the high site, they move them around on their different pads. So these 66 antenna can be put in a wide variety of configurations all along this plateau. And these transporters are absolutely enormous. I think they have 28 wheels and the power of two Formula One race cars. I mean, this kind of like macho stuff in a way. And so, of course, the press likes
it's
to cover things.
It's very easy to jump onto it. Yeah.
Yeah. And so anyway, so Alma said, you know, we don't understand who you are, but if you become media, we might understand you better. And so I put together a film team in New York, and we went down and we filmed at Alma in 2012, in August, and we filmed all around, sort of trying to get local and ecological context, sort of, and then we filmed at ALMA, and we were essentially filming the last stages of construction. And this completely impressed me. I mean, it was a mammoth undertaking. It was absolutely stunning, the scale and complexity of this construction. The level of precision required is extremely high, but as an anthropologist, I was really fascinated by how much of this work is done by humans, obviously, but also through, like, really just sheer effort, screwing 5,000 screws to every single antenna dish.
So it's not like a big factory, it's people.
Absolutely. And so this was the film. So with the film, we went to the high site, and I was interviewing somebody up at the high site, and I asked him, this is one of the largest supercomputers in the world, is at the high site, and it's the correlator, and it correlates all the data coming from these different telescopes to make them cohere into a single telescope with, I think it would be a 9-mile diameter. And so all this data is flying around from being collected at fractionally different times, and the supercomputer correlates this, and that's what it does. But I asked someone, okay, well, so how many operations per second does the supercomputer do, or how does it work, and these kinds of things. And he was really quite incoherent. And after a while, he stopped, and he said, look, humans are really fragile at this altitude. Clear thinking is extremely difficult. And of course, there are people who work up there for extended periods of time doing very complex work. So they would tend to be on oxygen. And actually, my film crew, I was not on oxygen, but we had other people on oxygen. And even so, like the guy doing my audio, like the boom mic was falling and we were all like stumbling drunks, kind of.
Yeah. So it's very dry.
Right.
And there's no light pollution, I guess, as well, because it's very far away from civilization.
That is true. So this gets to a couple questions. So, right, it's extremely dry. It's very high in altitude. It's 16,500 feet. And the question of light pollution actually occupies a lot of my dissertation. Maybe I'll say a little bit more about that. But, yeah, the night sky is pretty incredible. Although, as astronomers know, dark sky landscapes are changing situations with this question of light pollution. And when I started going to Chile, I actually thought that the Milky Way, for example, was almost like oppressively close to me, like claustrophobic.
I'd love to
see it. Claustrophobic.
Yeah. Because obviously in the UK, and definitely in Manchester, you can't see it at all. And it sometimes feels as though the sky is a resource which we're depleting, in a sense, because of all the street lamps. And when you do go somewhere remote and you even see a faint wisp, it's very nice.
Definitely. I mean, I worked on this question. I don't know if astronomers use this scale, but I have started looking into the Bortle scale for dark sky spots. And I think it goes from 1 to 9, 1 being a true dark sky, 2, so very, very close to a true dark sky, would be so dark that the Milky Way would cast a shadow on the ground.
Wow.
And in Chile, some astronomers who took me observing around this area, like amateur observing, said they would consider it a 2 on the Bortle scale. And so the Milky Way has dimensionality and complexity and this kind of thing. It's really absolutely unbelievable. But light pollution is an issue in San Pedro. And it's interesting because ALMA is a radio telescope. It isn't concerned very much with light pollution in that region. And in fact, for the optical telescopes in Chile, they work with an office called the Office for the Protection of the Quality of the Skies of Northern Chile, which does regulate light pollution in the 3 northern regions of Chile. But ALMA doesn't work with them. ALMA works with the Chilean Ministry for Radio, and they hold swaths of the radio spectrum sort of in loan that they control and that nothing interferes with.
So it sounds like the Chilean government really know that they do have a very, very important resource and they know how to manage it.
Yeah, definitely. That's absolutely true. It's one of my biggest questions because on the one hand, how unlikely, how odd really to think about the sky as a resource and how many kind of like technological and social structures have to be in place to make that make sense. So as an anthropologist, you constantly try to think of everything as just a little bit off, a little bit strange, or try to make yourself see things as strange. So, yeah, the Chilean sky is a resource. Well, what could that possibly mean? And what does it enable, right? And the light pollution question is a big piece of that. I wanted to say that doing the film, I became really aware of how much I would need to look at the concrete physicality of astronomy in order to do my research. And that's because I would say my object, essentially, that I was studying is massive astronomical data or massive observational data, with the irony being you can't directly observe it. And so if this is my object, how was I going to begin to track it and track the social world that coheres around it? So I started to focus after this film experience of seeing this mammoth infrastructure and this huge material labor, I started to really track infrastructure and materiality. And that became sort of a way I could trace the shape and effects of this traveling object called massive astronomical data, which is not available to me as an observer as well. And so this is actually how I started to pay attention to the idea of sky as a resource, because like I said, what could that mean? What does it enable? And it turns out to have a very specific history and meaning. And so when we talk about the Chilean sky as a resource, we're really talking about the sky as a resource for light. We're talking about the sky as a resource for astronomical data, which is light. And in 1998, after sort of lobbying and consciousness raising on the part of the astronomy community, the Chilean government passed a law. It's the Chilean Law 686 of 1998, passed under the Ministry of the Economy to formalize the Chilean sky as a protected object and also as a regulatable object. And so this inaugurates sort of the work of light pollution. And that on its own produces a whole world of like measurement, science, instrumentation, technicity. So you have the astronomical community working through the Chilean sky, and then you have a whole other scientific community working on the Chilean sky. And I found that very, very interesting. And in Chile, one of my questions was, why would we call the Chilean sky a resource when the Atacama Desert is one of the most extractive resource frontiers on the planet? So the Atacama is a mineral field, essentially. And in the 19th and early 20th century, it was the location of a huge boom in saltpeter, in nitrates, which are used for agricultural fertilizer and for gunpowder. And so the Atacama is one of the only places in the world that has this, and it was an enormous resource boom and then bust in 1930. And after that, copper was reconstituted as the new sort of resource of Chile, and copper obviously is still huge. Chile is the world's largest producer of copper, and it mostly comes from the Atacama. And now also lithium salts from the salt flats. So lithium and other rare salts that are used in technology are also booming. And so I wondered, is it not risky to use the language of resource to talk about the sky?
It's really interesting hearing it used in that context. I guess the sky is not depletable, not exhaustible.
Exactly. So it's a very strange resource, but actually sort of true to the philosophical or like linguistic roots of resource, which means something renewable or inexhaustible. It sounds weird to the ear to me, but it has a completely different kinds of stakes than these other mineral resources. So the regulation of light pollution, when I first identified this as a big location of work that is supporting the development of astronomical science in the Atacama, for me it was really an aha moment for an anthropologist. Because here you have the Chilean sky, which is a naturally pristine environment. It's a naturally pristine object. But once you start to look at the regulation of light pollution, you start to see that it's also partially made by human activity and intervention.
So it's conserved.
It's
a conservationist set of laws.
Or I would say it's shaped. Because the kinds of light that we regulate depends on the kinds of light that the telescopes want. So yeah, preserved, but shaped. And
yes,
if we wanted different kinds of light, we would shape it in a different way. But also, the flip side of that is recognizing how much humans can damage this environment. The fact that we can regulate and protect and preserve it is the flip side of that, is that human activity damages this. And this was, as I said, an aha moment. Anthropologists love the question of what is natural and what is cultural. That's a key anthropological question. And so I was very interested in ways that the sky is definitely a pristine environment and then also has social and political work done on and around it. And the regulation of light pollution also interested me because I started to talk with people who do quality assurance testing on data.
And that's what the guys do. I'm in Manchester, dude.
Exactly. So George, Gary, and Tom, who I met today and spent the afternoon with, this is what they work on for ALMA in what is called an ARC, an ALMA Regional Center. And what interested me about these data quality assurance people is that they're removing traces of all sorts of other extraneous data. And in anthropology, I'm interested in the kinds of things that make data. These are relationships. These are events. These are whatever. And it raises lots of questions about archiving and accessibility. And to an anthropologist, I mean, it raises questions about value and valuation and how unstable these things are and how pristine astronomical data can become junk data and then have another career, another life, and be valuable to some other question. And actually, that takes us back to the big data. One of the things that people talk about in the quote-unquote age of big data is that data never die. They never cease to be potentially interesting or revelatory. And so what is different in a way. I mean, this is a simplification, I think, but we used to think that you had a question and then you went out to gather data about that question. And there was all kinds of paradoxes, just the question
bias,
shape what you even imagine as data or what you even begin to collect. And in quite a few of my conversations at ALMA, but also other observatories, they say this is one of the things that's changing. Now the point is gather the data as much as you can, as complex as you can, as big as you can, for as long as you can.
Store
as much of it as you can. The questions might come later. Like, you know, we never know what kinds of questions can be asked of this data, so we just have to collect and store it. And this raises huge infrastructural challenges about organization and retrievability that I find really quite fascinating.
And also who gets access to the data as well.
Exactly, yeah. And so at ALMA, a PI, a principal investigator, would submit a proposal to have an observation conducted, and the observation would be conducted for them, and then it would be worked on a little bit through data quality assurance people in Santiago, and then it would go to the European Southern Observatory headquarters in Germany, and it would have more quality assurance testing, and then it might go to a regional center like the one we have here in Manchester, and it would have further and more refined quality assurance testing. And at the end of that whole process, the data would go to the PI as processed. The raw data is in a particular file format, and the process data is in another one, but this is what I'm learning about here today. So the PI holds that data as intellectual property for a year, and then it goes public. Related to this, in Chile, I was surprised to learn that this is not the language necessarily being used everywhere in astronomy. But in Chile, people told me quite a bit that part of what is going on right now with the new capacity to produce so much data is what they would call the industrialization of astronomy, by which I think they mean a hugely increased scale of the work and a real dramatic shift in efficiency. And with data at this scale, it has to be done in the way it's being done, or it would take too long, essentially. I don't exactly know how astronomers will come to feel about that or how they might reflect on that in terms of the history of astronomy, its historical trajectory. But I did see in the observatory sort of new classes of astronomical work, new labor hierarchies, but also basically just different ways of organizing the practice of astronomy that I find quite interesting. And the other thing is sort of related to this resource question and the ways that astronomical data sets, though they do become intellectual property, obviously they're not monetized. They are a kind of circulating scientific value, but they're not monetized. They're not really instrumentalizable, as far as I know. And so this sort of stuns me about astronomy, that in our current sort of global political and economic conditions, we continue to support something that doesn't have instrumental sort of like price tag.
I guess it does have reputational price tags and stuff as well, and that's what encourages people to join these collaborations in the first place. So that's what encourages countries to put in the money put up for the science in the first place.
Yeah.
It will further the reputation of them as an academic resource.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and I think, but when I ask astronomers this question, first of all, they would point out that astronomy is not hugely funded. The projects are expensive, but compared to things we spend money on, we could be doing a lot better with our support of astronomical research. But the other thing is this question. When people talk about the value of astronomy, they leap very quickly and almost always to this question of universal human heritage. And anthropologists don't really believe in universals. But I'm an anthropologist who said my object was the universe. And so I've tried to take this question really seriously about how something of universal human heritage works in a very specific local, Northern Chile or Manchester, United Kingdom, and sort of all the local specificities and pieces of this network.
So that's an interesting question that I did want to ask you about, is how do the researchers and the scientists who work at ALMA, how do they talk to the local people and how do they encourage them to have an active part in the community or not, maybe? How do they convince them it's a good idea to have these telescopes on the top of a mountain where they are?
It really depends on a range of questions about how people are located in this community.
Has it encouraged science in schools, for example?
Yes, definitely. So the community closest to Alma, the Alma Array, is Tokonau, which is a small indigenous community of Atacameño or Likanantay people. Likanantay is the indigenous language, and Atacameño would be the Spanish name for the indigenous people of northern Chile. And Tokonau is the closest community to Alma. Alma leased the land from Tokonau, and they have contributed a lot of money to the Tokonau school for science, language learning, these kinds of things. Also other kinds of community projects. I think Alma has been trying to work on some like water questions, which are severely important and challenging in the Atacama. But San Pedro is down the road, and it's a little bit of a different story. San Pedro is an enormous tourist hub for sort of like adventure tourism, like sandboarding on dunes and hiking across the Salar and seeing these amazing sights of the Atacama. It's a huge tourist location and has
I can imagine there are adverse effects to tourism coming closer and closer to the radio telescopes, for example, mobile phones and that sort of thing. So is there competition there?
Yeah, I think definitely. One of the ways that the observatories negotiate and justify their presence, which, you know, most people are quite thrilled and proud of this sky and of this presence of high technology and high science. Many, many people are very proud of it. But whenever there is sort of skepticism about how much these projects are doing locally, the answer is always that the observatories bring astrotourism to Chile. And indeed, in these communities, you find many, many small observatories run by local people that actually do quite a bit of really interesting astronomy, including Andean astronomy, and do bring tourist dollars. But there's clearly a conflict here, as you say. As far as I know, people are just at the stage of saying this is a clear conflict. We can't say that the value to Chile is astrotourism when astrotourism will eventually come in conflict with the observatories. It's a big contradiction. But Alma is in a 90,000 hectare preserve called the Atacama Astronomical Park.
And so for now it's safe.
I believe they don't find themselves as threatened by the RFI environment, the radio frequency interference environment. I don't think they find themselves as threatened as other places.
Especially Manchester, actually. Jodrell Bank has a big problem with it. And they often hold discussions with local councils about building new houses in Goosetree, which is very close by. So, it is a lot harder here, and it can show how expanding accommodation can really hurt your data if you're not careful. But I'm glad to hear that Alma is safe for now.
Yeah, it's safe and an extremely beautiful and interesting.
So you'd recommend astrotourists and some of our listeners go to Chile and take a look?
I absolutely would. It's an extremely fascinating and beautiful place, and now Alma's open to visitors.
Yeah.
And check it out.
Yeah, and this was a really interesting interview as well. So thank you very much, Katie Detweiler.
Thank you. It's a pleasure speaking with you, and I hope I'll get to come back, talk with you again.
Oh, that'd be really cool.